Dateline, Baltimore, Maryland. Stepping Stones to Mars. The Voice of America brings you another program on timely happenings in the United States and the world. Today, a report on a scientific gathering which discussed ways and means to explore Mars and other planets of the solar system in the years ahead. Here with today's program is Rhett Turner.
Throughout the 1960s, the United States has pursued as a national goal the landing on and exploration of the moon by 1970. This project was set out by Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and has been the focal point of manned spaceflight by the United States to date. Beyond the moon landing program, no long-range plans have been approved for further concentrated and lengthy exploration. However, the space agency has made recommendations for the future. In the summer of 1965, a 36-member group of scientists, members of the National Academy of Sciences, conducted a study and recommended that the planet Mars be the next focal point of U.S. space research. This decision was made because Mars comes near the Earth and is most practical of the planets to reach technologically. Also, it still appears as the most likely of our neighboring planets to contain some sort of life forms. During the last week in March, a 3-day conference or symposium was held in Baltimore, Maryland, at which hundreds of engineers and scientists discussed both the technology and theory of interplanetary exploration. The meetings were titled Stepping Stones to Mars. The gathering brought several hundred leading scientists and engineers from government, industry, and universities across the United States. Some of the foremost authorities on astronomy, biology, and the engineering sciences read technical papers about their respective disciplines, about plans each was making for planetary exploration. Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, is one of the foremost repositories in the world for data on the planet Mars. Hundreds of thousands of astronomical photographs and studies dating back for decades have been compiled at Lowell to further knowledge about Mars. Dr. John Hall, director of Lowell Observatory, outlined for the symposium some of the facts and fallacies which exist about the so-called red planet.
I would like to begin by paraphrasing some immortal words of Winston Churchill and say, with regard to the planet Mars, never in the history of science has so much been written by so many based on so little. Perhaps there is good reason for this. Man is a social-minded creature and consequently is extremely curious regarding possible existence of animal life anywhere else in the universe. But the fascination regarding Mars arises from a number of other circumstances. Once every 16 years, it comes close to the Earth and is then, of all the planets, the most favorably situated for observation. To be sure, Venus frequently comes a little closer, but Venus is not a spectacular object in the telescope. And being between us and the sun, she presents her dark side toward us at nearest approach. When Mars comes closest, we view its surface and atmospheric features under ideal conditions.
Dr. Hall explained that only the moon was as interesting to scientists as Mars, but that its lack of atmosphere and severe temperature changes make it unlikely there is life there. Mars is more challenging.
The central problem with regard to Mars is the possible existence of life, either at the present time or at some time in its past history. This question is obviously not an astronomical one, and I leave it entirely to more qualified scientists. However, this present hesitance of astronomers to dabble in foreign scientific fields was not one of their more outstanding characteristics at the turn of the century. The discovery by Schiaparelli in 1877 that canali, or lines, existed on Mars aroused a tremendous amount of public interest. The presence of lines was confirmed by many conscientious observers and stimulated considerable speculation about intelligent beings on the planet. These hypothetical creatures, for purposes of irrigation, supposedly created canals, traversing many of the desert-like areas. Books and papers were devoted to this subject. The lines would, in some cases, represent canals thousands of miles long. Furthermore, some were later observed to cross the maria, or dark regions, where water was suspected at that time to be plentiful. Neither of these factors seemed to suppress speculation. Why intelligent beings should have embarked on an irrigation venture of this magnitude is open to serious question. Perhaps we earthly mortals have been a little bit conservative.
Dr. Hall explained that nearly 500,000 images of Mars have been collected over a period of 75 years from all over the world. What about the lines or so-called canals of Mars, features which have been observed now for many years? Are they real? What are they? Again, Dr. Hall.
Some of the students of Mars, notably Lowell, have made the assertion that the canal network of Mars is of such striking geometrical regularity that it cannot be explained as a natural phenomenon, that it must be artificial, the work of intelligent beings. Our representation of the network can hardly support such a conclusion. It presents considerable irregularity and does not make the impression of artificiality, end quote. Within recent years, the reality of the lines has been questioned by a few astronomers. These believe the lines represent disconnected features, which, because of psychological reasons, have been recorded as continuous. Perhaps the apparent disagreement can be attributed to a question of semantics. All lines, in a sense, are a sequence of disconnected points. So are the lines of Mars facts, or are they fantasies? I personally believe that many of them, particularly those which have been photographed, must be real. The final answer to this question must await more comprehensive photographs of Mars than those that were taken by Mariner 4.
The Mariner 4 spacecraft gave man his first relatively close-up look at Mars as it flew by the planet last summer. Other than from these pictures, all information available to astronomers has come from Earth-based telescopes.
Much of what we observe on Mars seems in some way to be related to its polar caps. These caps change periodically in a completely predictable manner with the Martian season. The presence of an atmosphere on Mars has been known for many years because of observations of the formation and disappearance of the polar caps and the appearance of clouds above them. Furthermore, the planet is enveloped in a haze which is only occasionally penetrated in blue light, but which is nearly always transparent to the yellow and red.
Dr. John Hall of Lowell Observatory. The seasonal appearance of the white cloud suggests ice crystals. Red and yellow clouds are apparently dust clouds carried aloft by winds. The Mariner 4 photograph showed only a small fraction of the planet, so we as yet have no clearer explanation for the so-called canals. Mariner showed us extensive cratering on Mars, a surprise to most astronomers. Though many are now pessimistic about life on Mars, scientists simply do not know. And not knowing for sure means that there is an area to be examined, to find out. The Space Science Board, which recommended exploration of Mars, was headed by Dr. Colin Pittendrig, Dean of the Graduate School at Princeton University. Dr. Pittendrig, also a prominent biologist, outlined to the Baltimore Conference the biologists' views on the question, why go to Mars? In 75 to 100 years of biological study, the life scientist has discovered an amazing unity in all life forms. Also that certain protein substances are vital keys to the existence of life and replication or reproduction. Dr. Pittendrig explained.
Everywhere in terrestrial life, we find a common pattern to the structure of cells and of cellular organelles, membranes, mitochondria, nuclear apparatus, and the like. And everywhere, a more remarkable unity in molecular constituents. Everywhere, the essential catalytic functions are discharged by proteins. Energy transfer effected everywhere by ATP, and the synthesis of proteins controlled today everywhere by an elaborate system of the nucleic acids. The same enzymic cofactors are found in organism after organism. Particular metabolic pathways recur from cell to cell in daffodil, elephant, and microbe. And everywhere the fundamental functions of information storage and replication are assigned to the nucleic acids. The circumstantial evidence for a naturalistic origin of life is by now overwhelming. For the biologist familiar with the contributory facts, the naturalistic origin of life from the non-living world is itself, in effect, a fact.
It is in pursuit of the origins and causes of such complex chemical systems that the life scientist is directing his activity today, said Dr. Pittendrig. Though today biologists are convinced life evolved from non-life, that the organic evolved from the inorganic elements of the cosmos, the search goes on for the things which control, which carry information to guide life as it develops. Again, Dr. Pittendrig.
What we do not understand and what we have almost no glimpse of is the nature of the long chemical process which led to increasing complexity, increasing accumulation of information without the help of natural selection. We do not understand the chemical evolution that preceded replicating systems, a chemical evolution that in the long run made chemically replicating systems possible. That uncertainty about the early stages of the origin of life, the stages prior to the existence of a replicating mechanism, frustrates us. Why? We learn that the number of planetary systems in nature, presumably comparable to our own, is staggeringly large, say 10 to the 18th, perhaps 10 to the 20th. What we are facing here is the prospect of the most truly exciting extrapolation or inductive step that science has so far been permitted. The great extrapolation appears to be on hand, that life is abundant in nature, that terrestrial life is but a member of a large class of systems that replicate and perpetuate themselves. And if you think about this long enough and you're convinced enough about it, with Fred Hoyle, if you're a Lancashireman, you look in the sky and ask not where is there life, but where is there a cricket team that can beat Yorkshire. Apart from that piece of nonsense, it helps to underscore the immensity of what is at stake in the discussion. The biologist, as I emphasized, takes it as in some sense fact that living things emerged from a non-living origin, that the origin of life was a chapter in the natural history, the evolution of one planetary crust. Given the prospect of 10 to the 20th such planetary systems, the origin of life must indeed be fantastically improbable for life on this planet to be unique in the universe.
So the challenge to the biologist is to go beyond the Earth to find out how special life on Earth happens to be. By exploring another planetary body other than our own, the scientist may learn more about the possibility and probability of life elsewhere. By learning any new facts about extraterrestrial bodies, we deduce more about our own uniqueness or common place in the universe. Dr. Pittendrig further explains.
And here is the reason why the biologist is pressing for Martian exploration. The fact is that Mars is not, to the best of our knowledge, so fundamentally different from Earth as to exclude the possibility that living organization, even broadly in the terms as we understand it, has emerged there. And the further remarkable fact is, of course, that the possibility of exploring Mars and other planets in this solar system now exists, and without question, in my mind, is the greatest scientific dividend of the new space technology. It is a possibility whose realization has already begun with a magnificent success and the surprising discoveries of Mariner 4. The National Academy of Sciences convened a summer study in 1964 on the possibility of exploring Mars from a biologist's viewpoint. And last spring, we published the recommendations of that study. The study concluded that the possibility of life on Mars was sufficiently reasonable to justify the mission and itself emphasized the point I will press again later, that even if life is absent, the mission is fully justified by the array of biologically motivated questions to which answers certainly can be obtained.
The biologist urged first an orbiting craft around Mars and a landing craft later to send back information on the character and content of the planet. Here again, Dr. Pittendrig and more of the biological scientist's orientation toward examination of other planets.
In exploring Mars and other members of our system, the intellectual orientation is largely historical. How did it originate? How has it changed in time? How have the crusts changed and the atmospheres? What chemical complexity has been achieved? Has that chemical complexity everywhere taken the same directions? Will there be amino acids, purines, etc., on other planets? Has the organization essential for life been achieved elsewhere? If not, can we begin to get a clearer picture than our present provincial view permits of precisely what conditions made that great step possible here and impossible elsewhere? Can we make at least some progress towards the great inductive step that confronts us concerning our unique or our commonplace status in nature as a whole? Very few issues in science are settled by single observations, and when they are, those observations are only terminal steps in a long and often fuzzy struggle to clarify the issues. If we find life soon on Mars, as we might, the great inductive step will be promptly justified. But if we do not, and we have executed our exploration properly, we will at least have made a beginning, and we will be that much closer to a decision on the probability of life elsewhere than we would ever have been without the exploration.
Dr. Colin Pittendrig of Princeton University. Engineers have found that one of the primary considerations in learning about possible life on Mars is to see that the instruments sent there from Earth do not take any small terrestrial life forms along. Otherwise, the presence of such tiny Earth microorganisms would confuse the research on Mars. So, sterilization, complete sanitation of every component on a space vehicle, has come to be a momentous challenge to our technology. It created great interest among the gathering of scientists and engineers attending the Stepping Stones to Mars symposium. Dr. Lawrence Hall of the National Space Agency is a biologist in charge of seeing that American instrument craft going to other planets are free of living organisms. He explains why it's necessary to sterilize the vehicles.
There are two basic reasons. The most important is that we hope to be able to detect life on Mars or other planets if it exists. Now, if we carry life to those planets with our spacecraft and with our experiments, we, of course, will find life there, life that we brought with us. So we cannot take any life with us, or that's what we will detect. This is our most immediate reason for wanting to sterilize spacecraft. The second is that we do not want to infect a planet any earlier than we have to, and thereby affect the indigenous life that might exist on that planet.
But every attempt is being made to kill all life on board an Earth-launched spacecraft before it is sent to Mars. And this is the process called sterilizing a space capsule. Again, Dr. Hall.
We are attempting to do so in our early spacecraft that will fly to the planets by killing all life on board. And that is what we mean by sterilization, that there shall be no life whatsoever left on board the spacecraft, either on the surfaces or in the interiors of the spacecraft. Now, by interiors, we don't mean that if you open a little door in the side that you find bugs in there. We mean that there shall be no bugs a centimeter below the surface of this solid or of any other solid in the spacecraft, because if the spacecraft should impact at high velocity, it might shatter, and these organisms would spread and proliferate.
But it isn't easy to remove microscopic organisms which have been known to survive even outer space. Dr. Hall explains how it may be done.
Now, there are only two sterilizing agents that we know of that can accomplish this killing both on the surfaces and in the interiors. These are heat and radiation. Now, radiation is just as damaging, or in many cases more damaging, to spacecraft components than heat. So heat under controlled conditions is the method that we prefer to use. The exact amount of heat is being studied. It is a complex job to assure ourselves of exactly how much heat will be needed. Originally, we thought that we would require 135 degrees centigrade for 24 hours. But recent studies have shown that we can safely reduce this to 125 degrees centigrade for a maximum of 22 hours, and it's quite possible that we can reduce it even more.
But subjecting many of our space instruments to such heat has in effect cooked or fried them. So new instrument systems must be devised to withstand the sterilizing heat. It was at one time thought that it would be necessary to sterilize each tiny part all the way from its source into the finished spacecraft, containing thousands of parts. But it has been found now that assembly under sealed, antiseptic conditions and special clean rooms reduces the number of microorganisms to the point that a final heating process can complete the removal of living cells. Human beings outside reach through bacteria-free gloves to work on spacecraft parts inside the clean room. The spacecraft is literally built inside a germ-free can. Then the whole mechanism is heated to 125 degrees and hopefully all remaining organisms killed. The sealed canister opens after it is launched into space. Scientists are confident that any organisms encountered in space would also have reached Mars. It is known that spores, some of the smallest and most hardy of microorganisms, do survive the environment of space. Many spore compounds on Earth are preserved by similar vacuum and extreme cold conditions. If such microscopic life organisms do exist in space, scientists believe they would have long ago reached Mars, the Earth, and other parts of the solar system. There is even some speculation that the origins of life on Earth may be connected to these organisms. Thus far, they have not been discovered in space. So, scientists are exerting the greatest of care in designing instruments to probe other planets in search of life as we know it. The standards are high for craft being designed by the United States to go to Mars. Dr. Hall explains.
The present requirement is that the sterilization be such that there be only one chance in 10,000 of there being a single viable organism on board the spacecraft when it's launched, when it leaves the Earth's atmosphere.
A challenge indeed to engineers who know that normal matter on Earth contains 10 to the 8th microorganisms. Assembled in a bacteria-free clean room, this may be reduced to about 1 million microbes on a spacecraft. After heating in a sealed canister, they hope possibility of living organisms may then be reduced to 1 in 10,000. After instruments on Mars, man and another whole technology goes to work, that of developing spacecraft and an environment to sustain human life in space and on Mars for up to 2 years. A great segment of United States technology is devoting itself to such an undertaking. Dr. John Hedgepeth of the Martin Company is one engineer engaged in designing manned craft for a Martian trip. In coordinating a segment of the Stepping Stones to Mars symposium devoted to manned spacecraft design, Dr. Hedgepeth pointed toward the great problems in shielding man from dangerous radiation in space, in concepts of nuclear power development for space propulsion, environmental systems for man on the surface of Mars, and other problems peculiarly relative to human safety. He said it would probably be easier to land on Mars than to land on the Moon. This is because of such things as the fact that Mars has some atmosphere, and it can be partially used to slow spacecraft coming down to the surface. Mars is not expected to have the surface radiation dangers that the Moon has. More gravity on Mars means less difficult maneuvering on the surface. With the many technical problems involved for such ambitious space exploration as sending man to the planets, it may take 15 to 20 years to work them out. Speaking as one engineer who has watched and participated in the fast-evolving technological revolution we're experiencing today, Dr. Hedgepeth said this about future spaceflight.
I don't know whether it's ever going to be really desirable to take a manned mission to Mars. I feel that before we do go to Mars, before men do go to Mars, there's got to be some kind of technological breakthrough which will produce us a system that is different from any that we can envision nowadays. Propulsion, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe it's something we don't even dream of now. Let me just mention to you a possibility. You might be familiar with the existence and the growing use of microelectronics. It's getting so that we can package flip-flops, which are essentially information storage units, into volumes which are now getting down to the order of size of a human brain cell.
Flip-flops are tiny chips of silicone or other crystalline material upon which complicated electronic circuits can be implanted.
Maybe by the time that we're technologically capable of transporting men to Mars, maybe by that time we will have developed what you might call robots, which would constitute essentially a very high fidelity extension of a human being's senses. These robots would make, of course, great use of these microelectronics. So from that standpoint, maybe it doesn't become desirable at all for a man to go physically to Mars, that he would be better off sending his robot to Mars because the robot could be made lighter, possibly, be made more special purpose to do whatever is desirable to be done on the Martian surface. I don't know. I know it's going to be a long time before we go to Mars at all as a man in body. And this microelectronics thing is going to change all of our lives so tremendously in the next 10 to 20 years that it's impossible to predict what things are going to do.
An intriguing thought, isn't it? And truly, who can predict the scientific and technological advances just around the corner from us today? Participants in our current manned space program say that only man, with that miraculous computer between his ears, can exercise the judgment needed to cope with unpredictable situations in space. This has been shown in the Mercury and Gemini orbital flights, where machines failed and only the judgment and skill of astronauts have brought missions to a safe conclusion. But nevertheless, it is from the ideas and speculations, the dreams and the devotion of such men as John Hedgepeth, Lawrence Hall, Colin Pittendrig, John Hall, and the hundreds of other scientists and engineers who met in Baltimore recently that we may truly lay the first stepping stones to Mars and beyond. This is Rhett Turner reporting from Washington.
Today on Dateline, you've heard highlights of a 3-day conference of engineers and scientists planning man's first trip to the planet Mars. Tomorrow at this hour, another interesting Dateline program.